CDC estimates over 26,000 people suffer from asthma. If you're one of those people and find that the treatments and medications you've been prescribed aren't working out as well as you'd like, my guest physician this hour hopes to bring a breath of fresh air. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope you'll join the conversation this hour as we take your questions about asthma symptoms, treatment, and the possibility that we can go beyond treating the symptoms of asthma and finding a cure. Our phone number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, and you can tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. David Hahn is a recently retired family practitioner for Dean Health System in Madison, and he's the director of the Wisconsin Research and Education Network in the Department of Family Medicine at UW-Madison School of Medicine. He's also the author of the book, A Cure for Asthma, What Your Doctor Isn't Telling You and Why. Dr. Hahn, thanks for joining the show.
You're very welcome, Cynthia. Glad to be with you. Even though I'm not in town, I'm talking to you from Florida, where we are taking a break for a couple of weeks, and I feel for you up there.
You're very wise to get out of here.
It was a fortunate coincidence.
Yes, and it's funny to see. I'm in my studio here. I can see into the lobby, and I'm watching all of my colleagues walk in, all bundled up like little walking marshmallows wrapped up in 13 layers of clothes. So
been there, done that.
Enjoy Florida while you can.
Thank you.
Well, let's start out with the basics, just describing what asthma is and what some of the standard symptoms are.
All right. Well, asthma is a chronic lung condition that's characterized by recurrent and persistent wheezing, chest tightness, shortness of breath, sometimes chest pains even. It's triggered by a variety of factors or stimuli. It could be anything from, like today, cold air. Often allergens are triggers for symptoms. Common and severe triggers are respiratory illnesses, viruses, perfume, smoke, but basically any irritant that gets into the lungs can trigger episodes of what we call reactive airways or bronchospasm or inflammation, where the airways either get twitchy and contract and cause acute symptoms or become inflamed with mucus and inflammation, almost like poison oak on the surface of the skin. You can see the same reaction in the airways, and that's a much more dangerous, long-lasting inflammation. So there are multiple mechanisms for causing the same symptoms, so that when you use the word asthma, it's kind of a wastebasket term. There are probably several different underlying conditions causing the same symptoms and several underlying causes. For instance, I think in the popular mind and actually in the expert guidelines back in the 90s, asthma was considered an allergic disease. It was sort of identified as caused by allergies, but that is probably not the full picture. Allergens are certainly a trigger, but there's very little evidence that they're an underlying fundamental cause for asthma, and that's where my interest got tweaked years ago when during some research we did in the late 80s and 90s, we saw a very strong association of wheezing and asthma with a specific lung infection. And that's the direction I've been going in over the last 20 to 30 years.
Well, before we dig into that, and I'm very interested to hear more about it, talk about what happens when someone is diagnosed with asthma, I guess, on a typical basis. What are the next steps and prescriptions that a physician might provide?
Well, the current guidelines are based on the concept of step care therapy, that you tailor the treatment to the severity of the asthma. And the severity can be intermittent or it can be persistent. Intermittent means, you know, you only have symptoms occasionally. The most intermittent form might be the what's called exercise-induced asthma, where the trigger is mainly exercise. So a lot of high school athletes, for instance, will take a puff of albuterol, it's a bronchodilator, before exercising on the practice field, soccer, football, whatever, and that is enough to take care of their symptoms, and they don't have problems any other time. Someone with mild allergic triggers might complain of symptoms during the spring, maybe the fall. Take a little albuterol, or perhaps the next step up, which is inhaled steroids, but the rest of the year they're fine. And then it goes up to persistent, where you basically have symptoms on a more regular basis. And it's very hard to kind of quantitate that, but there are, the guidelines will say if you have you know, certain symptoms more than a couple of times a week, you're called persistent. If it's you know, almost every day, it's kind of moderate persistent. And if it's basically continuous and basically creating havoc with your quality of life and on a daily basis, that's called severe. And it's a little bit difficult. You have to look at it case by case to sort of quantitate these, but people can identify themselves pretty easily if you talk to them in the office. Now, that's severity, and so the treatment is based on the amount of severity. So the more severe you are, the more basically anti-inflammatory treatments are required, and those are generally inhaled steroids, Flovent and budesonide and stuff like that. And after a certain point, if that isn't controlling the symptoms, then you add something called a long-acting bronchodilator into this, into your inhaler, and that adds more benefit to many people. Not all. That's the issue here we're going to talk about. And then there are others. There's something called a leukotriene inhibitor that works for some people, but generally inhaled steroids are the mainstay for asthma. Now, if you max out all the treatments and you're still not controlled, and I'll talk about that in a minute, then you're said to have refractory asthma, which means the current treatments don't work. Now control is a slightly different concept. Severity is supposed to be determined before treatment, so that you know what the baseline severity was. After you start treating, then you're talking about how well do these medicines control the symptoms. And it's a slightly different concept, because you can have severe asthma that can be well controlled, or mild asthma that can be poorly controlled. So the two concepts don't overlap entirely. And there is a very simple 5-question test called the asthma control test, which is available online to anyone who has asthma, so they can actually gauge how well controlled they are. It's very simple. I do it over the phone frequently when people call me for advice from all around the country. And it's a 25-point scale, and if you score 20 or above, you'd be considered well-controlled, and below 20, not well-controlled. It's not entirely clear where the cutoff for really, really bad asthma is on that scale, but generally there's kind of a consensus among some of us that if you score 15 or less, you're really in bad shape. And to give you a perspective on this, people are calling me who've identified themselves as refractory, and a lot of these folks are not scoring below 15, they're scoring below 10. So we're, in my experience, has been with the worst of the worst.
Well, as you describe some of the treatments for asthma, it sounds like the treatments aim to chip away at the symptoms that aggravate an asthma sufferer, but don't necessarily provide a cure.
I think that's true. Everybody agrees that even when inhaled steroids work, they suppress symptoms, but they don't cure them, because inevitably, if you stop treatment and your asthma is still active, then the symptoms will come back within a few days or a few weeks. The caveat here is that asthma, the natural history of asthma is that it can wax and wane, so that there are some people who I described, for instance, people who have problems in the spring and the summer and this fall only. Their asthma is going to wax and wane, so they're going to get better on their own. But for people with severe persistent asthma whose symptoms don't get better, when you stop your inhaled steroids, bam, you're back at square one. So yes, whatever the underlying cause or causes for asthma are, they can be suppressed but not cured by the current treatments, which are called controllers. In other words, they control but they don't cure.
We're talking with Dr. David Hahn. He's author of A Cure for Asthma, What Your Doctor Isn't Telling You and Why. We're taking your questions as well at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. Do you suffer from asthma or know someone who does? What treatments were you prescribed, and were they enough to dispel the symptoms that you suffer from? Did you develop asthma as a child, or was it later in life? What triggers it? You can let us know. You can ask Dr. Hahn questions at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with Dr. David Hahn. He's author of the book, A Cure for Asthma, What Your Doctor Isn't Telling You and Why. We've been talking about the symptoms of asthma, what triggers it, and why conventional treatments that were often prescribed don't seem to be enough for some people. You can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, or you can leave a comment on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Dr. Hahn, you had mentioned earlier that there might be an underlying cause of asthma that could be, in fact, persistent infection. Tell us more about that.
Okay, yeah, I think I'm fairly well convinced that this is an underlying cause for at least some people, and I'll tell you why. I actually got into this line of inquiry by studying a lung infection by a bacteria called Chlamydia pneumoniae back in the 80s when it was first reported. Now, this is not the chlamydia that causes sexually transmitted diseases, but it is a cousin, so it behaves similarly. So we know a lot about chlamydia in general, but this one tends to target the lung, and it was first described as a cause for acute bronchitis and community-acquired pneumonia and more severe pneumonia back in the 80s. So it was of interest to me because, as a primary care doctor, I was always treating people with these conditions. So I wanted to learn what the causes were, and the treatment for this bacteria is a little different than others. It doesn't respond to the usual things like penicillin and amoxicillin and Keflex and all that. So if you tried to treat a pneumonia with those antibiotics and it turned out to be due to chlamydia pneumoniae, you were not going to get a good response. So it was important. So I launched a study with a dozen of my primary care colleagues in the Madison area, and we enrolled people in what we called a cough study. We were looking at all people who had a persistent cough of any kind just to see how many of them were infected, and we were able to reproduce the findings of the original group from Seattle who had reported on this. And we found that the acute infection from this bacteria caused about 1 out of 20 cases of bronchitis and about 10% of pneumonia. So we found that out. That was useful, that this bacteria wasn't just limited to, say, Washington State. It was probably all over. But during this study, I started noticing that a lot of people who would come in with respiratory illnesses would also wheeze, and some of them actually had asthma or developed asthma during the study, and invariably, they all had very high levels of antibodies against this bacteria, and I thought that was kind of interesting. But the thing that really turned me on to this was one case, and I'm going to tell you about this 45-year-old woman who had never had respiratory problems in her life. She wasn't smoking. She was just, you know, very healthy. She got a bronchitis with wheezing. We call it acute asthmatic bronchitis in these days, but back then that nobody had ever described it, although it's very common in primary care. And she turned out to have an acute infection with this bacteria that we proved by our testing. And the thing that I want to emphasize is her wheezing never went away. After 6 months, she was still coming back to me all the time, and we were giving her the treatments that we had in those days, which was albuterol and theophylline. We didn't have inhaled steroids in those days. And so after 6 months, I knew very little about asthma. I sent her to one of my pulmonary colleagues. He did pulmonary function and interviewed her, said, this is asthma. And in fact, it continued until I gave her 3 weeks of doxycycline, which is the antibiotic that was used against chlamydia pneumoniae in those days and still is. And her wheezing and asthma completely disappeared for a few weeks. And then it came back again, and she asked me for more antibiotics. I gave her 2 more weeks of treatment, and she went into complete remission for 2 years.
How does someone contract this bacteria, though? Is it like catching a common cold?
Exactly.
Okay.
It's ubiquitous. It is not as easily transferred. If you catch a cold, usually you'll get it within a few days. This bacteria is very slow to develop. Takes several weeks. There have been a lot of documented transmissions within families, but it's not dramatic. One person will get chest cold, and 2 weeks later, somebody else will get a severe sore throat and coughing, and then 2 weeks later, somebody else will, and it's often easy to miss, but it's pretty well documented. Very slow transmission. And the other important thing is that it's now been fairly well demonstrated that very often the bacteria never goes away. It stays in the lung, perhaps causing mischief, perhaps not. But that's the key characteristic of chlamydia in general. They tend to cause persistent, chronic infections, which make them a logical candidate to look at in a severe, chronic, persistent lung problem like asthma. And I got pretty interested in that. Kind of went back to school, learned a lot about asthma, learned about epidemiology, and discovered that what I was looking at, or what I thought I was seeing, just was not described at all in the medical literature.
Well, you know, let's say I've had asthma for 10 years. I was diagnosed 10 years ago, and...
Truly? No.
This is hypothetical.
Okay.
Yeah. And now I'm hearing this, and I'm concerned. How do I know if what I have is truly asthma or if it's a bacterial infection in my lungs?
Well, it may be the same thing. It may be that you have asthma,
mm-hmm.
and that the underlying cause in your case could be a chronic lung infection. And here's where things get muddy, because there hasn't been enough research to clarify the answer to your question. I'm talking about chlamydia pneumoniae.
Mm-hmm.
There are other candidate bacteria that have been identified that could also play roles. Mycoplasma pneumoniae is another candidate that has been described, although the evidence supporting it is not anywhere as robust as it is for chlamydia pneumoniae. And frankly, we're now learning about that there are so many different varieties of bacteria inhabiting the human body. There could be others that we don't even know about. The thing that I do know for a fact is that some people, and I'll try to give you a profile of who they are, who take a prolonged course of antibiotics that are targeting chronic infections will have dramatic responses such as I described with that case report. In her case, it disappeared entirely, and I have seen other people like that, again, with the documented infections, caught early enough that they disappear. The asthma goes away.
Mm-hmm.
The longer you've had asthma, you've had it for 10 years, the longer you've had it, the more likely there are to be residual symptoms. And so it's not, you can never guarantee a response. That's number one. Number two, because of the lack of research, we do not have any testing that's able to identify specifically, yes, you are infected with chlamydia pneumoniae or mycoplasma, and of course you can't have a test for a bacteria you don't even know about. So we do not yet have a blood test or any kind of test that will predict that antibiotics will work. The only thing that I've found that is a predictor is the severity of the asthma. The more severe, the more treatment resistant, the more likely it is to respond to azithromycin. Hello?
Yep, I'm here.
You're there, okay.
We heard you cut out, but I'm glad you're still there.
Yeah.
We're talking with Dr. David Hahn. He's the author of the book, A Cure for Asthma, What Your Doctor Isn't Telling You and Why. And we're taking your questions about asthma, treatments, symptoms, all that jazz at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also ask a question or leave a comment on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let's take a call from Julie in Madison. Hi, Julie.
Hi. My question is, my son has had asthma most of his life. His father has severe asthma, but most of the time he feels fine. A couple years ago, he ended up in the intensive care unit, but in between, he feels fine. So they've kind of diagnosed him as a poor perceiver of his symptoms. I guess my question is, how important do you think it is for him to continue to take inhaled steroids when even his pulmonary function tests in between show no significant change when he's on them or off of them, but when he gets a cold or some other infection, that seems to trigger and things tend to go, you know, spiral downward. So is it okay to just start them when he starts to feel bad, or is that too late?
That's a really good question, and this is a scary sort of situation. I think there are kids who and adults who have what I call acute severe asthma or intermittent severe, that they're This is, the most worrisome kind of asthma, where you seem to be well all the time until you get that cold, and bam, you're in the ICU. That's kind of scary. And it is probably, for a case that severe, it is probably not enough to just start inhaled steroids at the time of the cold. Generally, for an acute severe, what we call an exacerbation or a bad attack, whether you are having baseline symptoms or not, you require systemic steroids, oral or even IV steroids if you happen to hit the emergency room. And it's borderline whether to admit or not, you can give IV steroids and observe for 12 to 24 hours. But this is a case where I can't make any specific comments about your son. I hope he's under the care of someone who's knowledgeable about asthma and can help you manage this.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
But I will say that this is an opportunity for me to say that the kinds of approaches I'm recommending do not require and should not involve changing current controller medication. In other words, if someone is on controllers for inhaled steroids or whatever for asthma, and they decide to adopt this treatment from their physician if they think that's reasonable, the controller should be continued, because if you get a response from antibiotics, it's going to take months. It's not going to be rapid in most people. And so it's very important from a safety perspective that people's asthma continue to be managed with the current treatments according to your doctor's recommendation. Now, the question, I can't really tell you how to manage your son's asthma. How old is he now, by the way?
He's 19.
Oh, 19, okay. What I'd suggest he do, if he's a poor perceiver, are you implying that he actually does have symptoms all the time, that he just doesn't?
No, he doesn't seem to.
Yeah, so
it's like when they, you know, and he's like, oh, I feel great, I feel fine, even after he was discharged from the hospital where they said his lung function was 50%, he was like, I feel great.
Right. So, there are a lot of people in the community with asthma who've lived with it for a long time who function really well, and they're employed, and they have, no real complaints, but their lung function is low. And do you know whether his function is completely reversible? Does it go back to normal after he has had a round of steroids or a hospital treatment, or does it remain low?
It went back. I think it's always shows some obstruction, but yes, it did get much better.
Again, you'd have to talk to your pulmonologist or pediatrician or allergist or whoever about that. But there is a group of children and adults who've had asthma for a certain amount of time who will develop what the specialists are calling airflow limitation. And what they really mean is irreversible lung loss of lung function. Another term for that is COPD. These are all very vague terms for the same condition. And about 20% of asthmatics will develop accelerated loss of lung function over time, so that throughout the years some of them will end up with COPD and later in life. But the natural history, I've seen this happen over a lifespan, is it starts with bronchitis, goes to asthma, ends up as COPD. So there's the natural history of this condition is not well described and not really, it's just beginning to be acknowledged by the guidelines, but they're not anywhere near where they need to be. And here's a hypothesis that I'm interested in. It's not proven, but because we know that chlamydial infections are known to cause chronic damage and scarring and inflammation in the tissues they infect, it's plausible that this subgroup of children and adults who develop lost lung function that isn't regained, that could be possibly due to this chronic lung infection. And there are analogies in the medicine, two that come to mind. One is, I mentioned the other chlamydia trachomatis, that causes STDs, sexually transmitted disease.
Mm-hmm.
It also causes infertility through scarring in the tubes of the female genital tract, and that happens over years with chronic or repeated infection. Another one is an eye disease called trachoma that is the leading cause of blindness, treatable blindness in Africa, and that's because of a low-grade infection as chlamydia, the same chlamydia that gets in the eye. And that's preventable by early treatment with antibiotics in the early stages before the scarring occurs. And my hypothesis is that this same process is occurring in this subgroup of asthmatics who are infected with chlamydia pneumoniae. Not proven. We do have preliminary evidence that supports it, but one reason I wrote this book is this subject has been neglected now for over two decades, and I really would like to see more research done to try to find out whether this hypothesis is correct, because if it is, that has huge implications for treating early onset asthma.
Thanks for that call, Julie. We also received an email from Michael in Menasha, or rather he called in to say that he's read that anyone with lung issues like asthma should be checked for adrenal function. He says low cortisol levels are often the cause for inflammation in the lungs. Is that true?
That's not my understanding. I'm always open to new ideas, so I will keep that in mind and look at it. But in fact, in my experience, the opposite is the case, that asthma is a disease that involves lung inflammation. The inflammation is treated with steroids, either inhaled or oral. Some of that is absorbed into the body, and that suppresses adrenal function. So there is a relationship between asthma and adrenal function, but it goes the other way than what this gentleman was suggesting. It's adrenal suppression occurs as a side effect of the treatment, and that is one of the major side effects of treating severe asthma with steroids. Is you get chronic adrenal insufficiency that needs to be managed.
Mm-hmm.
That just illustrates the fact that not only do the treatments not work for everybody, if you take the treatments, they can have serious side effects, not only adrenal suppression, but glaucoma, hypertension, diabetes, osteoporosis, especially if you're taking oral steroids for the severe asthma. Inhaled steroids were developed as a better target. You use lower doses targeted to the lungs, less absorption in the body, but nevertheless, with high-dose inhaled steroids, you can still get those side effects I mentioned.
We're talking with Dr. David Hahn. He's author of the book A Cure for Asthma, What Your Doctor Isn't Telling You and Why. David Hahn is also the director of the Wisconsin Research Network in the Department of Family Medicine at UW School of Medicine and a recently retired family practitioner for Dean Health System. We're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. What questions do you have about asthma and the treatment of asthma? What have you been told about asthma and the available treatment of options? Is there more you want to know about it? You can let us know. Our email address is also talk@wpr.org. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Joy Cardine on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Wisconsin Public Radio, and we're talking about asthma. We're talking with Dr. David Hahn, author of the book A Cure for Asthma, What Your Doctor Isn't Telling You and Why. We welcome your phone calls at 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, and you can tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Dr. Hahn, let's take a call now from Madhav in Milwaukee. Hi, Madhav. Madhav, are you there? Sounds like we have lost Madhav. Well, Dr. Hahn, I wanted to ask you about this research that you've done on the possibility of an underlying infection in the lungs. And you said that more research needs to be done in order for example, maybe the FDA to approve different treatments for asthma symptoms. What are the next steps in that area?
There's a lot of ways to go. You can approach it from the point of view of doing clinical trials of various antibiotics in groups of asthmatics to see if you have an effect. I think that could be done. I'd love to do it. I haven't been able to get funded to do that. there's not much incentive out there for pharma to do it because the drugs that work are all generic. So that's a barrier, but I would definitely pursue clinical trials. And as a side sidebar, there are now enough preliminary trials done. We've done two. Groups overseas have done some, and another group in the U.S. did one with using what are called macrolides. These are the ones you probably they're in the class of erythromycin, but that's not the one I would use. But the one that's used most often is azithromycin. That's the one I've been using, and you can dose it once a week for long term, and it's pretty convenient. There's now enough of those trials to have performed something called a meta-analysis. That means you take all the trials that you have, combine them together, see if there's a consistent benefit or effect, and the recently published meta-analysis just a couple weeks ago concluded that there were beneficial effects on asthma symptoms, asthma quality of life, and on peak flow, which is a measure of how fast you can blow your air out. So there's now enough evidence to do to say, hey, it looks like something's really going on here. It's not just that crackpot from Madison saying stuff. It's now, I think, beyond that. So you could do two kinds of trials. You could do a straight-up pharma trial like you were implying the FDA approves, which is you randomize people to azithromycin or placebo and see what happens. There's another approach that is possible called a comparative effectiveness trial, which there is an entity now called the Patient-Centered Outcome Research Institute that funds studies where you take two accepted approaches, but you want to find out which one is better. So let's say you took folks with refractory asthma. The current approach is you refer to a specialist and they try all kinds of stuff, and it usually doesn't work, and it's super expensive and has bad side effects. That's all that's there for a lot of these refractory asthma people, and that's why I think they're very interested in this research. They're the most interested group. So why not do a comparative effectiveness trial of usual care versus azithromycin and see if azithromycin is superior? So that's the clinical trial approach. The other approach is what's called looking at mechanisms, or looking at, gee, is it really chlamydia pneumoniae that's underlying this? Is it other bacteria? Are we off base and it's some other mechanism entirely? After all, these medicines, azithromycin and the macrolides, also are known to have anti-inflammatory properties themselves, apart from their antibacterial properties. So the experts currently, if they address this at all, they will say, well, it's an anti-inflammatory effect of azithromycin, and that fits into the current kind of paradigm that they're that the guidelines are based upon.
Well, Dr. Hahn, we have only about 15 minutes left, and I want to get some callers in here. Let's talk to Trudy in Port Washington. Hi, Trudy.
Okay.
Hi. I am here yet. I was on Amsax and Erythrosin, and now my doctor has given me the nebulizer, and he's got me on Advair. And I don't know what to do. I have changed. My body has changed.
Do you have, has he diagnosed asthma?
He's found asthma on me, yes.
All right. And how old are you, ma'am?
I'm 89 now.
And when did you develop asthma?
Pardon?
At what age did you develop asthma?
Well, they tell me I had it before, but 8 years of age.
Oh,
I was in school, I missed school, and they call it bronchial. So I don't know.
Okay. And has he done pulmonary function tests to tell you whether your lungs are 100% of what they should be, or are they less than that?
As far as I know, not.
Okay.
Because he's taken care of me for 22 years.
Right. It is true in general practice that pulmonary function testing is not utilized as much as I think it ought to be. In order to kind of find out what's going on in your lungs, it would be advisable, in my opinion, to ask your doctor to do something called pre- and post-bronchodilator pulmonary function testing. This will tell him important things about your lungs. It will tell you, first of all, what's your baseline? Are your lungs constricted or lower than they should be? Do they respond to the albuterol or the nebulizer medicine you're getting? Do they open up? And then after they've opened up as much as they can open up with the treatments he gives you, are your lungs now at 100% or are they still decreased? My guess is that you probably have a mixed picture of perhaps some reversibility, but perhaps you also have some what we call fixed obstruction or COPD. And step would be to find out more about what you have. Are you having lots of wheezing and chest tightness and shortness of breath?
Mostly a lot of heavy breathing.
Heavy breathing,
since the third surgery. Heavy breathing.
Okay, yeah, it's very difficult for me to say anything specific about your case. Other than it might be good to have further diagnostic tests. Have you ever been seen by a pulmonary specialist or someone like that, a lung doctor?
No. I've been seeing different doctors as my age goes up and new doctors come around, but I've had this one for 22 years.
Right.
And he's been trying everything, and he will not give me any antibiotics anymore.
Right. Well, you know, I've spoken to a lot of folks like you, and sometimes I can get a clear picture of what's going on, and sometimes I can't. And in your case, I'm a little bit befuddled and not able to give you a clear cut answer. I have seen people who, if they've tried everything and they did have asthma or do have it, a long course of azithromycin can be of benefit. And if your doctor finds out you actually have COPD or a component of COPD, the recommendation for azithromycin is even more solid than it is for asthma, because although the people who do the asthma research at the NIH have chosen not to do a long-term trial of azithromycin, they did do a long-term trial of azithromycin for people with severe COPD. I'm not sure that you fit that category, but if you did, the results were generally quite positive. There was a subgroup of people, about 1 out of 7, who got a really good symptom response. And overall, after a year of treatment, the amount of exacerbations was decreased. And so the treatment trial did, in fact, support using azithromycin for COPD. And I was a bit surprised by this because, in my experience, people with COPD are less likely to respond to azithromycin than people with severe asthma. So it looks like perhaps this medicine might be useful all along the spectrum that I was talking about of severe asthma and COPD.
Thanks for that call, Trudy. Let's go next to Sue in Eau Claire. Hi, Sue.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Dr. Hahn, I've just received your book. I ordered it.
Oh, thank you.
Several years ago, just out of the clear blue sky, I was diagnosed with severe COPD, which I have always felt was misdiagnosis. I was playing golf. I had bought new golf bags. I was working on the trail, doing all these active things. And in 98, I got pneumonia and was in the hospital for 8 days. And I was sent home with azithromycin and Cipro. And during that time, I was on, I can't think of the name of it right now, Symbicort at the time. Mm-hmm. And I kept telling the doctors, none of this really works. In fact, albuterol literally made me so I could barely breathe. But when I was on the azithromycin and Cipro, I barely needed any medication for breathing. And so I have always felt a misdiagnosis. I have spent thousands on drugs that have never really helped. And when I was sent home from pneumonia, I was on oxygen for a short time, and then it didn't make any difference. And that seems to be all anyone wants to do at this particular time, is put me on oxygen. And I feel I need help.
Okay. And so how many years? So you were doing well, you had no lung symptoms, then you got pneumonia.
I was a little short of breath, but I was walking the golf course, you know, and bought a new bag to walk.
How old were you when you got the pneumonia?
Let's see, in 68, I was 61.
How old are you now?
71. Beg pardon?
How old are you now?
76.
Okay, so it's been a decade or so or more.
Yeah.
Are you
my
using?
My voice is funny now because I'm nervous. I can't believe I'm actually talking.
You're using inhaled steroids and all the asthma type medicines, and they're not helping. Is that what I'm hearing?
Oh, I use now it's on Spiriva. I've gone back and forth.
Right. And okay. Did you smoke during your life?
Made any difference?
Did you ever smoke cigarettes?
I did. I was a long-time smoker.
Long-time smoker. Okay.
And I feel that was the reason. That bang, there's the diagnosis.
Right. That tends to be true. There's two things that I want to respond to. I'm going to start with the more general comment and then specifically talk about you. The general comment that is in primary care, I think listeners to this show have already gotten the sense that it's kind of a muddy picture. What's asthma? What's COPD? What's this? What's that? Well, it turns out that in real life, these lung conditions are very hard to distinguish, and a lot of people have what's called the overlap syndrome with a little bit of asthma, some COPD. Maybe they smoked, maybe they didn't. Specialists tend to try to categorize people into one or of the other buckets, but in fact, if you do that, you're required to ignore the middle ground, which is 30% or more of people. So this clearly isn't classic asthma. It doesn't sound like classic COPD either, so maybe you have the overlap syndrome. The drugs that we use to treat them are pretty much the same. The differences are more cosmetic than real. And so it sounds like you've had a refractory lung condition for quite a while. Now, have you gone to a pulmonologist to try to rule out the fact of rarer underlying lung conditions that can cause symptoms like this, like pulmonary fibrosis or pulmonary hypertension or stuff like that, bronchiectasis? Those are terms for other conditions I'm just tossing out just to see if your doctors have considered alternative diagnoses.
We've actually lost Sue. So what answers might she find in those providers?
A good pulmonary diagnostician to rule out rare underlying causes that have the same types of symptoms. But the other thing I was going to say to her, she's not a clear-cut case, but I have a lot of folks who contact me because they have chronic asthma, and their doctor will give them a Z-Pak, that's azithromycin, for 3 to 5 days to treat an acute respiratory illness, and they'll notice that their condition gets better for a couple of weeks. And they become curious about it, and they either ignore it, or the second time it happens, they get a temporary benefit. They'll ask their doctor, and he'll usually say it's coincidence or maybe anti-inflammatory, but then they go online and find me. And it's not, we don't have scientific proof for this, but I think that's another indication that long-term antibiotics like azithromycin may result in a long-term benefit in those people who have already noticed that it seems to help them in the short term, very similar to the first case report of that woman I told you about earlier, where she had a temporary relief with 3 weeks of medicine and then a longer remission with a longer course of treatment. So those were the two things that came to mind when talking to that woman.
In our last couple of minutes here, you've given us a lot to chew on. So what's your parting advice for asthma sufferers as they consider some of the things that you told us today?
Well, I wrote, as I said in the introduction to the book, I wrote it for two reasons. There is a large number of folks out there who have severe refractory asthma. The tip of the iceberg are contacting me for advice, and they're very frustrated because their doctors are not aware of this. It's not in the guidelines, and it's not really being talked about in the medical community. So I wrote the book, number one, so that they could take something to their doctor to help educate her or him. This contains stories. It contains all the hard science. There's several chapters that could have been written as reviews in medical journals. So it's all there. Hopefully that will allow a dialogue. The second reason I wrote the book was, as I kind of implied, it's been since the late 80s, early 90s. There really hasn't been much movement in this area, at least not enough in my opinion. So the second reason I wrote the book is to try to move things along a little bit more. I don't know if it's going to help. I don't know if folks at NIH are going to read this book, although I've sent it to several program officers. And my primary care research colleagues around the nation and actually overseas. So those are my two messages. Patients with severe refractory asthma who benefit, the way things get done in this country is special interest groups of patients with a certain condition get together, and often in this country the squeaky wheel gets the grease. Mm-hmm. So if there are enough people who feel this is valuable to help them or their family members, they believe it's something they can advocate, they should be out there getting together just like other...
Okay. Well, Dr. Han, we are running out of time. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. This is Dr. Han, author of the book A Cure for Asthma, What Your Doctor Isn't Telling You and Why. Thanks to Bill Martins, Christy Taylor, and Robin Cherry for producing this hour. I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is the Ideas Network.